All right. Very excited to talk about this week's movie. No, that's Jason Voorhees. That's actually not the monster we're talking about. That's the wrong franchise, but... No, that's Psycho, I think, or Pig. I'm not sure what exactly that's... I don't know what that is, but our monster doesn't talk, so why are you trying to get me to go to sleep? That's... Okay, that's better. All right, we're getting on the right track. Maybe we should just start the show before this goes completely wrong.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Happy Halloween, junkies!
Oh. Pull out your Halloweenies. It's time for Halloween.
Oh, yes. So, so excited right now.
Four more days till Halloween. 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 Four more days to Halloween. Silver Shamrock.
Every year. I love it. It never gets old to me. I love the fact that it circulates around social media, the Silver Shamrock song. And I know that a lot of you are probably thinking that we are about to talk about Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
We are talking about underrated sequels this month. However, you know, again, a Fantastic Fest reference. I was in the Fantastic Feud several years ago. I was called up to the, you know, front where you do the battle, the face-off.
Yeah.
And we were asked, name an underrated horror sequel. Bam, my hand goes down, and I answer with this. Now, no one else had answered with this because several other had said Halloween 3 is an underrated horror sequel. But Halloween 3 has gotten some love over the years as an underrated horror sequel.
It's rebounded.
And I think this is a truly underrated horror sequel.
And we'll get to that movie in just a second. But I want to remind you that we are available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher, all of our back cataloged episodes. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And hi, this is Junk Food Cinema, by the way. I'm Brian.
Welcome to Junk Food Cinema. Yeah, if by now you haven't figured out who we are, I'm Lieutenant Megaforce. He's fucking Brian Salisbury.
I'm the trick to his treat. And here we are once again talking about
the Field to My Haddon.
Yes. The Loomis to, no, you know what? Never mind.
The Tango
to your cash.
Goddamn right.
The fruit of your Loomis. I don't know why.
Which has two different meanings.
I don't know why.
Both of them kind of creepy.
I don't know why. But we are still talking about underrated horror sequels, and as Cargill's story illustrates, Halloween 3, while, you know, it suffered a lot when it first came out, and it suffered specifically because people were expecting another film featuring their favorite white mask boogeyman, Michael Myers.
Favorite or second favorite?
At that point, 78. Yeah, I would say he was probably the favorite at that point. I mean, Voorhees hadn't even shown up yet. And we were still a ways off from Freddy when Halloween 2 came out. So, yeah, audiences were like, all right, we're going to see Michael Myers again. And instead, what they got is a story about consumerism and Celtic lore and witchcraft and not at all. And Tom, oh my God, Tom Atkins being an absolute badass.
Yeah.
A great movie. I think one of the rare instances where capitalizing on a name brand hurt a film. Yeah. Because if that movie had just been called Season of the Witch, I think the reaction to it at the time would have been a lot warmer, a lot more favorable.
I don't know. They would have been gone, where the fuck is Nicolas Cage?
No, I don't think
so. At the time, may have been still Nicolas Coppola.
Yeah. Where the hell's Nicolas Coppola in this movie? That would have been a weird thing for someone to say. Like, very prescient. Like, that person is obviously some sort of soothsayer and should be harnessed for their abilities.
Or burnt as a witch.
Or burnt as a witch, perhaps. But that is why today's movie that we're going to be talking about is simultaneously very important for a horror franchise and also wildly underrated, and that is Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers.
Yeah.
Now, this, I have to, you know, share a little bit of personal history. My first foray into horror films was watching Halloween when I was about 6 or 7 with my parents, who watched it every year. And it was such a big deal for me to get to watch the movie with the grown-ups that while I was certainly scared because I am a human and that movie is Halloween, it didn't scar me. I was too excited about, you know, getting to watch a movie with the grown-ups to really care about how scary the movie was. And from that point on, as I got older, as I went through elementary and middle school, I started watching slasher movies kind of exclusively. And what I would do is I would watch the first one and then rent, you know, over the course of a weekend on VHS, all of the sequels. So I ran through Friday the 13th, and I ran through like the Psycho sequels, and I ran through all the other, and then I ran through all the Halloween sequels. And so I probably watched Halloween 2, Halloween 4, and then a little bit later, Halloween H2O, more times than I can count. Like, those were like big deal movies for me. And then, of course, like right in the middle of this discovery, last week's director, Wes Craven, released Scream, like right about the time I hit about 12 years old. And it was just like perfect. And all of a sudden, I wanted to go back and watch Prom Night, and I wanted to watch Terror Train, and I wanted to watch all these movies that were being referenced in Scream. And Halloween 4 became like one of my favorite go-to movies. And it's so interesting when you have the opportunity to fall in love with a movie when you're younger and watch it all the time, and then revisit it as an adult and discover new things about it that really not only allow it to hold up, but make you enjoy it even more.
Yeah, and Halloween is a weird series.
That it is.
It's a really, really weird series. There's no series like it.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a first film, which is a classic, upon which one of the other classic series was blatantly ripped off. It was accused of being blatantly ripped off. The creator denied blatantly ripping it off, and then later on said, oh yeah, no, I totally fucking ripped it off. And that, of course, is the Jason series, the
Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm. Was ripped off from it. Then the plan was to make it an anthology series where every film was a different horror movie set at Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And just call them Halloween.
I got to say, a pretty awesome idea.
Pretty awesome idea, but they made the mistake of, oh, wait, I've got an idea for a second one.
Yeah.
So let's do that, and then let's move on to this thing. And by then, they'd established a precedent. So when people went to see Halloween 3, they were expecting Michael Myers.
Right.
So that killed this franchise for a little bit. Then they came back with a fourth one. It's Return of Michael Myers. We're going to resurrect it. We're going to pretend the third one didn't happen. We're going to move right along like the Muppets. And it didn't do so hot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one we're talking about now. So then they go to immediately follow this one up with Halloween 5, but it's direct-to-video.
Yeah.
And it's in the direct-to-video era. Now, this stands as the only franchise to have one of its sequels go direct-to-video only to return to cinemas.
Yeah.
Because, like, Hellraiser went to direct-to-video and never came back. Once you go direct-to-video, that's it. You're banished there forever. Except not Halloween. It did it early enough, and it came back late enough. And despite the fact that its sequel, that sequel, Halloween 6, sucks shit through a straw.
Yeah,
it continued and then went on to be reinvented in the postmodern era, you know, and it's a Halloween film through the lens of Wes Craven. Think about that for fucking second.
Yeah.
A series from a John Carpenter created series through the lens of Wes Carpenter movies or Wes Craven movies.
Yeah.
That's what 7 becomes. And then they go and make a terrible sequel with 8. Just,
Resurrection is horrid.
Horrid. But
it's offensively bad.
Is playing off of the reality TV concept.
Yeah.
At the time that then they decide, fuck it. We have fucked this series so bad from pillar to post.
There's nothing we could possibly do to make it worse.
Let's start again and start from scratch. And they bring in Rob Zombie to make Halloween, which leads to Halloween 2, which is arguably the most inexplicable of the series. And now there's supposedly a third Halloween in the works that exists in that series.
Yeah.
So literally, we are going into what appears to be the 11th film, the 10th Michael Myers film. It is all over the map in what it is as a franchise. That level of continuity there is here is completely fractured.
Yeah.
And what you end up with is a series in which films 1, 2, 4, and 5 exist in their own continuum. Then 7 changes the rules and tries to retcon certain movies and tries to ignore 4 and 5, and everyone's ignoring 6.
As well they should.
Because 6 goes off and creates a whole nother kind of sub universe and tries to explain the mythology in a way that breaks the mythology, so much so that there are 2 functionally different versions of that movie. There's the movie that was the released, and then the bootleg version, the producer's cut, which most fans argue is the better version.
Well,
of that.
And here the really weird thing about 6 is that it is, I find it the most offensively bad because it is Donald Pleasant's last film on this planet. He's still playing Dr. Loomis as best he possibly can. And yet the fucking asshole director of part 6 decides he doesn't like Donald Pleasance and largely cuts him out of the movie, like cuts his part way down. And that to me was that is one of the most egregious things about it. But it does play off of a really bizarre ending to part 5, like an almost inexplicable left turn that 5 takes.
Oh, see, I love that inexplicable turn. That's what the
and
the
6
thing that
tries to play off
five.
Of that. 6 tries to, yes, it does, yeah, because it brings it goes, back the whole idea of the cult, and that's why they wanted Jamie in the first place, and she wasn't really in a hospital when the baby's born. She was in like the lair of that same cult. Like they try to dovetail it, but it doesn't. It just like nothing about it works. Nothing about it works at all.
You mean 5 or 6?
No, I mean 6.
Yeah, yeah, no, 6. 6, at the end of 5, here we're left with this idea that there's this supernatural force, that there's, that you know, Michael Myers is not a human being, that he is being driven by some supernatural force. That supernatural force is coming to help him and get him out because it needs him in the world. What the fuck is this? We'll find out in the 6th one, and it turns out, it's science. Every generation, evil is born into a person, and it's scientifically proven, and this just happens to be this, and he's a genetic mutation.
You know what's bizarre about that? It makes more sense, continuity-wise, to assume that mysterious man in black from Halloween 5 didn't follow him to Halloween 6, but instead went to Jason Goes to Hell.
Yeah.
Because they also have a mysterious man in black character that it's like, oh, it makes more sense to think that, oh, it's just that same guy going from franchise to franchise who fucking shit up.
Yeah. So, yeah, that I would argue that 6 is probably the most offensively bad, but at least it has a continuity, whereas Halloween 2, the second series Halloween 2, actually doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Where the first act of that movie is actually a dream sequence. The beginning of the film is the beginning of the second act, and then the third act is a Kubrick movie and doesn't make any fucking sense at all, and ends up with a white horse walking down the hallway in an insane asylum, and you're just like, ah, fuck this.
Yeah. Not since The Happening have I watched a director lose his mind as he's making a film, and that's what we got with Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. So let's rewind. Let's go back. Before the ship completely hits the rocks, we have Halloween 4.
10 years ago, on the night of October 31st, a small Midwestern town fell victim to an escaped killer. Ever since that night, no one has forgotten his name. And Halloween has never been the same. Now, Michael Myers has come home. He has returned for one more night of unholy terror.
And Halloween 4 is...
Now, it's one that if you're a fan of H2O...
Yeah.
Which I don't know why you would be, but you might be.
Hey, I am a fan of H2O, guys.
I don't know why you would be.
Because it hit me at the exact perfect time.
No,
I was 14 when that movie came out.
It's totally cool.
Yeah.
It's totally cool that you love your super short movie that totally blows the continuity of 4 out of the water. But
does it, though? I'm not sure that it does.
You have to buy into a universe where Jamie Lee Curtis fakes her own death and leaves her and abandons her daughter.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's paid for it with having to be Josh Hartnett's mom. That's her penance, and date people like Adam Arkin. Like, there's a lot of penance that she's paying, and she has to deal with LL Cool J being her security guard on a daily basis. Like, there's a lot of things that she deals with that it's
that just totally pretend that four never existed, and four's one that should exist.
Well, but it makes sense that H2O would pretend four never existed because Jamie Lee Curtis's character isn't around for that. So why would she have any knowledge of the shit that went on in four and five and six? Like, she's been gone. And no,
she's dead in four.
She's dead in four. But again, like,
they try to retcon it by, oh yeah, she faked her death in that. But then you have to go, oh yeah, the reason why we knew she was dead in four was because her fucking daughter was missing her.
Yeah, which they don't. They take a while to establish in four that is in fact her daughter, despite the fact that the little girl played by Danielle Harris,
who has she ever been in a horror movie before?
There was this great moment at a Fantastic Fest where Danielle Harris was there, I believe, with Hatchet 2. And she, now Danielle Harris, as many of you know, has been sort of a mainstay of horror films ever since she made her big screen debut in Halloween 4 as a 6-year-old. Has been just, I mean, that's her bread and butter, has been horror movies ever since. And the poor, clearly at the last minute, asked to do this Q&A, moderator asked her, in all earnestness, not being funny, first question. So, how was it being in a horror movie? Because this is your first, right? And you could just hear the whole audience like, oh, dude, come on.
Your first question.
Give us something. Come
her
on.
Her whole career is horror movies.
Yeah.
Except for maybe, you know, a really awesome Shane Black script.
Oh, yeah. Every once in a while. Every once in a while. The basic plot of this film is that this is Haddonfield. It takes place
Last Boy Scout, for those of you who are like, wait, which one? I need to Google that right now.
Don't
Google it.
Cargill just helped you with that. So it's Haddonfield. It's 10 years since the events of that Halloween night with Michael Myers.
Unintentional, but we have chosen two movies in a row in which they are taking place 10 years after the original.
Yeah. This one, I think, was even less, was very much less on purpose, the 10-year mark, because this movie was in development for a while. In fact, Golan and Globus tried to make this movie initially because they had success with Texas Chainsaw 2, buying the rights to that franchise and then making the sequel years later. So they tried to obtain, their thought was, what we'll do is we'll go to John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, because obviously they're the creators, they have the rights.
And they're geniuses.
And not only will we buy the rights from them, but we'll get them to write the script. Well, John Carpenter's treatment for the script for Halloween 4, which the fact that he would come back, the idea that after not directing 2, and then only wanting to continue to make Halloween films that didn't involve Michael Myers, and then having Halloween 3 bomb so hard, the idea that he would want to come back to Haddonfield with Michael Myers is pretty astounding. So he writes a treatment. But he writes a treatment that had like a more like psychological approach to the Myers mythos. So it was like the town of Haddonfield, how had it changed? How had the events of the first two films affected it and its citizens? But it was rejected because they just wanted a slasher movie. So Golan and Globus decide not only not to take John Carpenter's treatment, but to walk away from the deal. That's when the rights go to Mustafa Akkad, who is one of the producers of the original movie and becomes sort of the helmsman of this franchise all the way to the end.
And if you wonder why that crazy history that we just laid out happened for the franchise, that's why.
Yeah.
Because that guy took hold of it, and it became very, very, he became so protective of the franchise, he would not let people do public screenings of Halloween movies without his personal approval.
Yeah.
Like, it was kind of crazy like that. Like, the Draft House would try to throw Halloween marathons, and he would say, no, I don't want that version of the film shown.
And it's so, like, there's a lot of great, if you can find information, there's a book, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but that kind of talks about the history of this franchise. One of the crazy stories is Mustafa Akkad ends up being killed in a terrorist bombing in Jordan he and his daughter. Like that's not the fate that one anticipates for a, you know, an elderly film producer. But it was just crazy stories abound around this entire franchise is my point. And so instead of getting yet another kind of different take on Michael Myers and what's going on, we get a return. We get a return to the Michael Myers kind of that we had known and the boogeyman that we loved, but in a very, very 80s package. Like, that's kind of one of the things I think drew me to this movie so much is that it's the elements of Halloween that I liked, but it could not be more an 80s slasher if it tried.
No, but the thing I love about this movie is not only that, and not only does it nail everything properly about an 80s slasher film, not only do they hit all the beats perfectly,
yeah,
it also has a bold as fuck ending. In fact, an ending that I think can only be compared to Sleepaway Camp.
Oh, shit. Interesting.
That the ending of this movie is closest to Sleepaway Camp than any other horror film that you can think of.
Yeah.
And I thought that was bold as fuck. Fuck.
Well, it's so bold, in fact, the ending of Halloween 4, that you get the impression that that was going to be the end of the franchise.
Yeah.
Like, you get the sense that they had brought it full circle.
We come full circle. We end where we began.
Yeah.
We end with the clown suit and the knife. And yeah. And this is how evil is born. This is how evil recycles.
Yeah.
That it is, you know, that it continues. It is a great, great bookend to the other two films. Like, if you look at them as a trilogy, it is a fantastic trilogy, especially since none of the supernatural shit has happened yet.
Yeah.
Like, the supernatural shit does not happen until the fifth film. So if you look at these as a trilogy, this is your final film of the original.
Yeah. And it's amazing too how they recognize that Michael Myers, and like, even as they haven't really gone with the John Carpenter treatment of building the mythos, I think there are so many little moments in Halloween 4 that, I won't say subtly, because this movie isn't like ripe with subtlety, but just these little moments that really build Michael Myers as a legendary boogeyman. And one of my favorites is, you know, Donald Pleasance, of course, reprising his role as Dr. Loomis. There's a moment in a gas station, in like a diner, where he's you know, Michael Myers has escaped, and he's tracking him, and he's standing in the middle of this diner trying to use the phone, and he turns around and he looks across the diner, and standing in the garage is a man in a hospital gown, and his face is completely bandaged because he hasn't had a chance to get back to that drugstore and get the mask. So it's just this very unsettling image of, we know who's under those bandages, but because we still can't see his face, it's a different face, but it's not Michael Myers' face. It's just so unnerving. And to have Donald Pleasance just stand there and say, "Don't, Michael, don't go back to Haddon," like pleading with him, like, "Don't go back to Haddonfield." And just the heartbreaking moment where you realize, like, there's no way he's not going back to Haddonfield. And he comes and ends up, you know, really terrorizing this young girl and her foster sister and their family, who we realize through the course of the movie is in fact the daughter of Jamie Lee Curtis's Curtis. Character, who was
his last remaining relative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who he hasn't killed yet.
You know who must be a real drag at family reunions? Michael Myers. That guy just is not getting along with anybody.
Well, what family reunion can you have? Oh, okay. Fucking killed it.
I guess everybody. He keeps knocking everybody off. There's not anyone left.
Maybe he just doesn't like family reunions.
I guess not. He doesn't want to. He doesn't like soggy potato salad and forced conversation. That's why he just wears the mask. I get it. I get it, Michael Myers. I'm totally behind you on that.
But you know, one of the great things about this film is the scene you were just talking about, the gas station.
Mm-hmm.
And the gas station is where you really, really get a taste of one of the things they do with this film, which is they let Donald Pleasance off the chain.
Oh, yes.
And he goes almost as crazy as Michael Myers.
Yeah.
Which is what's so great about it. And clearly you can tell that as an actor, as Donald Pleasance is, Donald Pleasance was one of those guys who he had the kind of Michael Caine, Samuel L. Jackson work ethic that we talk about every once in a while, where you don't get a phoned-in Donald Pleasance performance.
No.
He showed up to work, and when you hired him, he gave you his all. It doesn't matter what he was doing. And we've talked about a number of his films on this show because we are huge Donald Pleasance fans.
Oh, yeah. That's why Six pisses me off so much. I'm like, you have Donald Pleasance for the last time. Use Donald Pleasance.
Yeah. He goes all fucking out. I don't care if it's fucking Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band or if it's Alone in the Dark or what have you. He always goes full out, and here he turns it to 11. And this is the moment he makes Dr. Loomis a legendary horror character, because he went from very sedate in the first one to truly understanding and deeply caring of it as a doctor in the second one, where he really tries to save Michael. Then he realizes he can't, and he realizes he has to kill Michael, but he failed.
Yeah.
And where we thought he and Michael had died, they didn't. And now he's scarred up as fuck. Michael has been in an institution for 10 years, and goddamn it, he's gotten
coma.
Out. In a coma, he's gotten out, and he snaps, and he is trying to tell everyone, and he just, and at the first part of it, nobody fucking believes him.
Yeah.
Which leads to one of my favorite moments in an 80s slasher film of all time, when he shows up to the sheriff's department, and we get the scene where they're like, oh God, fuck you, this guy's crazy. And he goes, do you know who Michael Myers is? He's like, of course I know who Michael Myers is. He's back. And the sheriff goes, okay, let's go get him.
Yeah.
Like, literally, he's just like, I'm not going to fuck with you. We're not giving you this scene all over again. We've already had it twice in this movie. I'm going to buy it. I'm going to be a responsible sheriff. I'm not letting anyone get hurt on my watch.
Yeah.
And from that moment, you are invested in that sheriff. And even though you followed the teenagers in this movie, and the teenagers are screwing around, and the uber big breasted girl has her...
Just ridiculously huge.
Ridiculously huge breasted girl has her scene with the boyfriend. You're kind of like rooting for the boyfriend a little bit. By the time you realize she's the sheriff's daughter, you're like, that motherfucker better not touch her, because this sheriff is a motherfucker. I like this guy.
Yeah.
It's one of those rare times where the movie lets you like the sheriff.
Yeah.
Like, most of the time you're supposed to hate the sheriff.
Well, it lets you like a sheriff not played by John Saxon. Because
right.
If it's played by John Saxon in a horror movie, it's a sheriff and you love him anyway. But I get what you're saying.
But in 80s movies, the sheriff was usually a foil. The sheriff was the guy who told everybody to go home. He didn't believe them, and that there really isn't a monster running around. And this sheriff is like, fuck that. We're not letting anybody die. Let's go out and find this guy. But Loomis is unhinged, and he can, and the performance between this stoic sheriff and Donald Pleasance creates this really great chemistry that sets up a wonderfully executed third act.
Yeah, and I'll go one further on you. This movie not only establishes a sheriff that we can like, this movie establishes a posse of rednecks that we can actually like.
Yeah, except
the entire town of Haddonfield, there's this moment where they all realize that Michael Myers is on the loose. They all realize that they've lived. That's the thing, is this feels like a lived in Haddonfield.
Yeah.
This doesn't feel like, oh, it's just the same setting as the first two movies, so we're calling it this. This feels like a town that is sick and fucking tired of hearing about. In fact, that may be why, if you notice,
there is one flaw in this movie that goes to that, but we'll get to that in a second.
If you notice in this movie, the only character that even uses the name Michael Myers is Dr. Loomis. No one else refers to him by name. This is a town that is sick and tired of hearing about Michael Myers, that is sick and tired of being associated with that massacre 10 years ago. And when you get to the point in the bar where all of the bumpkins are like, fuck this, we've got to do something about this, and they take up arms and go after him, I'm sorry, I'm sitting there going, yes, please, please catch him. Like, this could have been a Last House on the Left dopey, you know, sheriff moment.
Yep.
But instead, like, oh, bumpkins, rednecks, whatever. No, this is a moment where I'm like, these guys actually care about their town. The interactions they have with Jamie and her foster sister are actually really sweet. Like, I'm rooting for these fucking guys to get Michael Myers.
And I love all of that about this movie, but it sets up the one thing I hate about this movie.
Go.
The fact that Michael Myers then walks into one of their stores and is able to pull a Michael Myers mask right off the rack.
Yeah, why do they still sell
like,
that?
Like, why would you, in a town that won't even use his name, why would you sell a Michael Myers mask in a Halloween store?
Because otherwise he would have had to have tracked down William Shatner, stabbed him, removed his face, bleached it, and put that on instead.
True story for the 12 of you out there that don't know this little factoid, the original Michael Myers mask was a William Shatner mask, a Star Trek mask that was spray-painted white.
They teased out the hair, spray-painted it white, and that is the birth of the Michael Myers mask, which if you
is apparently inexplicably on a shelf in fucking Haddonfield.
No, I'll give you that. It definitely raises some questions for sure. I get that. But no, I like that.
The rest of that, town, this is a town that was brutalized by a killer years before and reacts. And when they react in a very real way. And yeah, that mob then goes out and accidentally shoots people because they see someone in the bushes and someone runs into the bushes and they shoot him.
Yeah.
And what was that guy doing in the bushes? Well, that's none of your goddamn business, but we accidentally shot him.
I really wish it had been another member of the Tramer family. And again, this is just me being a huge Halloween nerd, but Ben Tramer is mentioned in the first Halloween and then inexplicably murdered in the second Halloween. It's by accident because they think he's Michael Myers and he gets run over by a car. I really wanted the guy who accidentally gets shot in Halloween 4 to be another Tramer.
Another Tramer.
Just that one little thing. That's all I was hoping for.
You kind of love that idea of like there's this family that lives in Haddonfield where it's like, you know, so much of their family has died as a result of Michael Myers.
But they weren't actually killed by Michael Myers.
Oh my God, Michael Myers killed. And they kind of tell, Michael Myers killed. No, well, it wasn't actually Michael Myers. Actually, a bunch of rednecks shot your crazy cousin because they thought he was Michael Myers. Well, yeah, but it was the night Michael Myers was there and they thought they were shooting Michael Myers, so it's his fault. Like, it's like this epic story of this family that's almost cool.
Yeah. And yet, you know what? I want to go back for a second to the idea of the mask being available in the store. There's a really interesting scene that I think is just kind of played off, but if you think about it, is really fascinating. And there's a scene where Dr. Loomis and the sheriff are driving down neighborhood streets, and all of a sudden they see Michael Myers, and then they see him again, and then they see him again. And they're surrounded by Michael Myers. And it turns out to be a bunch of high school kids just playing a joke that ends up with all of them almost getting shot.
Yeah.
But it's like, clearly there is an element to this town, the younger element, who were probably like very small children when, you know, 10 years ago, Michael Myers actually came home, who have kind of embraced it as kind of a cult thing that they are now a part of. So it's almost as if there's a generational difference going on in this Haddonfield between the adults who can't fucking stand the story anymore and these kids who were way too young when it happened to, maybe they weren't even alive or you know, were just barely children.
They're definitely alive.
But, you know, not old enough to really know what's going on, but they've latched on to it.
But this doesn't feel like a town that would let that fly. Like, I could have, if they'd made a little something of it, like there was a costume shop in town that was selling Michael Myers masks and people were really bitter about him. And he's like, fuck you, I'll do what I want.
Yeah.
I'm here to make money. And you see kids kind of buying them. Like, that concept, if they'd explored that, would be very cool. And maybe that's sitting on the cutting room floor. And maybe we're just supposed to just kind of write it off, as I do.
Yeah.
But, you know, because I still really dig the shit out of this movie, despite the fact that that gaping plot hole sits there. But yeah, maybe that is an element, but we have to fully invent that.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, there's nothing there that the kids in any way have a real disconnect to Michael Myers. Like, everybody seems to know this story.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, too, that, you know, we mentioned that Halloween 4 hits all of the 80s slasher notes so perfectly. And keep in mind, this is 88. So this is kind of well past the golden age of the slasher films. By the time you get to 88, like, things are starting to taper off in a big way. And what I like so much about Halloween 4 is while it is doing a lot of the things that kind of epitomize the genre, and which is fitting considering one of the movies that helped establish the American slasher was Halloween. The other thing that it's doing that I think is really interesting is that it is reinforcing something that the first Halloween kind of kind of subversively planted in the head of audiences, which was the idea that, you know, terror can come to you. White, middle-class, suburban America, like, the scariness isn't just in the woods. The scariness isn't out in the ocean. I mean, it can come to you. I mean, the tagline of the very first Halloween is "The night he came home." And I think that's one of the things that is so effective about the first Halloween. It is, it really is a shakeup to kind of just middle America. Is like, this shit can happen in your backyard. Like, this whole white picket fence ideal is not immune to nightmares. And I think one of the things that Halloween 4 does really well is reestablish the idea that this is such a, like, a picturesque community, you know, and very much a suburban community, and yet it rears its ugly head again. Like, all of these things that you try to not talk about, all of these things that a lot of the town would like to forget about, is coming back. And that scene where Jamie is trick-or-treating, and it starts off as such a really a sort of sweet scene, and, you know, everything's going well, and then in almost an instant she gets separated from her foster sister, and she's in the same neighborhood, but all of a sudden it is the scariest place imaginable. Like, the more lights seem to be out, it's getting foggier. Like, that same landscape is suddenly so alien and so creepy. And I think it's just another really interesting, subtle thing they do, where it's like, this is the exact same community where she lives. This is literally the place she was standing a few minutes ago and everything was fine. But just, like, take that one wrong turn and it's like, it's a place that is just as scary as, you know, the old dark house in the woods. And I think that's something that this movie also plays on very well, is that whole idea established by the first one, that, like, this can happen anywhere. And these picturesque little communities are no exception. So that's something that I think always struck me, you know, when I was younger, and especially now, is that, you know, the neighborhood that Halloween 4 takes place in, even more so than the neighborhoods in the original Halloween, which were largely shot in California, even more so than those, felt like my backyard, and it was just really frightening. And I don't think that's accidental. Like, I don't think that's something that they came across anything but deliberately, and I think it works really well.
Yeah, no, it's that's one of the things that always worked with those. And if you look at the best of the Halloween movies, it's always the thing that it's the quiet, sleepy town. It's any town. Haddonfield is any town, USA. It could happen anywhere, you know. And the bad guy in the movies was just this kid.
Yeah,
and this kid that was deeply possessed by something not right, something evil, if you will. And
he's not from another planet. He's not even from another town. He's from their own community. Not,
and unlike every other villain, every other major villain, you know, he's not avenging a wrong. Like, that's the interesting thing about all the other, and why so many of those, slasher heroes, you know, these monsters of the 80s, connected with audiences was, well, Freddy Krueger was murdered by a bunch of people and he's getting revenge. Like, that's what drives him. And
Jason Voorhees was picked on.
He was picked on and then ended up drowning as a result of being picked on, and he's getting revenge.
Which, by the way, is very much the giallo influence on slasher films, because that's what almost every giallo film was about.
Yeah. And then you have Cenobites, who are creatures from hell who are grabbing sinners and people who explore into the things they're not supposed to do, but they're driven by something. And the thing about Michael Myers that always worked for Michael Myers is you never know what's driving him. They never address what's driving him. Just whatever it is deep down fundamentally evil and wrong, and he just is driven to do these awful things. And so you have him again being that and doing that, and them not trying to place anything on it and not trying to place mythology on it in this one. They're just making another film about this monster coming home again and killing again.
Yeah.
And it's just fucking creepy, and it's scary, and it's effective, and the kills are every bit as good as the other movies. And one of the interesting things about Michael Myers in these early films is they're not trying to get creative. Yeah. It's not like, you know, in the Friday the 13th films, one of the hallmarks, the whole reason to see those, you never went to see a Friday. In the 80s, you never went to see a Friday the 13th movie for the plot.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the point. You did not go to see how are they going to beat him this time. When you read Fangoria in the 80s, every time a new movie would come out, they would publish the list, including whatever the new movie was, of all the different ways Jason killed another human being. Like, and they would list them in order numerically, as in, this is the one he killed with the garden shears. Here's the one he put through a pole. Here's the one, you know, in the Michael Myers movies, he just fucking killed people.
Yeah.
And sometimes he would do something like particularly brutal, but it was never about how creative can we get. And it's not that here.
There's not a single creative kill in Halloween.
No.
Like in John Carpenter's Halloween, none of the kills could possibly be described as creative.
Here they ramp it up a little bit.
A bit,
but not too terribly much.
No, and in fact, what's funny to me, you know, on that note is that when the rough cut of this film was shown, they realized that it really wasn't, it was a little soft. Like it really wasn't going to appeal to younger audiences because as a slasher film, it was pretty soft. So they actually hired Jean-Carl Buechler to come in and add kind of more grisly kills, like the guy driving the truck at the end who Michael Myers like basically twists his face off, which is really icky. And then, you know, just adding a little bit more blood here and there. I think my favorite kill in the movie, and a missed opportunity, in my opinion, unfortunately, is there's a moment where Michael Myers wrestles a shotgun away from a girl. And he's pointing the barrels at her. You think he's going to shoot her, which would be very lack of creativity to the nth degree. But instead, he reels back with it and impales her onto the wall with it.
It's my favorite kill for that movie, too. In fact, I think it's the iconic kill of this era.
But the missed opportunity there, of course, is that it's very similar to when he kills Linda's boyfriend in the first one. And they cut to Michael Myers looking at what he's just done. And you're waiting for it. You're waiting for his head to tilt. Just a little bit. Just like he did in Halloween. Because why else cut to his face at that moment? And then he doesn't do it.
But I like that because he's not surprised by himself anymore. I mean, I feel like that was an intentional callback of this is a much more sure Michael Myers who just isn't even interested in what he's doing anymore. He's just doing it. Yeah. Like in the first one, he tilts because he's admiring his work. Here, he's not even doing that.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I guess I could see that, but I wanted to see it. I think
he
it is.
You wanted to see the callback, which
I did want to see the callback.
Because
yeah.
that is, you know, if I'm correct and my interpretation's correct, that's subtle as fuck.
Yeah.
Like the first thing, the head tilt would have been subtle.
Yeah.
The not having the head tilt is really fucking subtle.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, the movie much better than almost anyone else watching this movie.
Yeah. 'Cause
that was not something I caught, you know, watching it as a kid. It was something I noticed now the same way you noticed it where you were waiting for that head tilt. And I was like, oh, he didn't.
Yeah.
Oh, that interesting.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot about this Michael Myers that is different. And I think that there's definitely a lot about this Dr. Loomis that's very different. This is a Dr. Loomis at the end of his rope. There are a couple of moments in this movie that I feel like when I say that this is very much an 80s slasher, there are a couple of just oddball moments that somehow, despite how silly they are, give us a better understanding, a better picture of Haddonfield as just kind of this out of the way backwater town. And at first I thought they were just silly moments, but then the first one being when Dr. Loomis is trying to hitchhike and that car full of football players and cheerleaders, like totally tries to get, like convinces them they're going to pull over and then they take off just because. And then immediately following that, he gets picked up by this preacher in an old truck who shares a drink with Dr. Loomis and then begins to sing hymns. And I swear to God, looks just like Crazy Ralph from the Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah.
And it's such a, like this coupling of oddball moments and you're like, where is this movie going? But
I love that sequence.
But to me, yeah, it's just like Haddonfield is a weird little town.
But the thing is, he's not from Haddonfield.
No.
In fact, what I love about that scene is there's that whole talk about being, holy men and about being men that are devoted and,
yeah,
and
chasing it.
They're chasing it. Mm-hmm. They are two men who are the only people that believe as strongly as they do in what they believe. And they're going out and preaching and the world isn't listening. And doctor, that's, and the thing is I find that a brilliant juxtaposition, because how we view this crazy preacher is exactly how the rest of the world views Loomis. Mm-hmm. Because we're with Loomis. We've watched the other movies. We know Loomis is right. There's never a moment in any of the fucking movies in which we look at Dr. Loomis and go, Loomis, you're out of your mind.
Calm down, bro. It's not that bad.
He's not that crazy, Loomis. Come on. He's not going to get away this time. It's totally okay to transfer him via ambulance on a rainy night. Like, what are you worried about? Like, no, we're always with Loomis. And what they cleverly do here is kind of show us how the rest of the world sees Loomis. Mm-hmm. They see him as that crazy guy in the truck going off, screaming about something that just calm down, old man.
Yeah.
And I feel like this movie, this is one of the things I love about this movie. I feel like this movie's a hell of a lot more clever mm-hmm. than it's ever given any credit for.
Sure.
That they really did know what they were doing and were making a subtle, intelligent slasher that was also trying to be a saleable slasher
yeah.
that then was neglected as being neither.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think it's one of those movies that expertly rides that line, but then kind of gets derided for not really being enough of either. And that's unfortunate, because I think it is a stellar sequel. I think it is a movie that upholds a lot about what made the very first film great. It brings it into the era in which it was made, and it doesn't feel like it's missed a step. The religion aspect is interesting too, because there's a line very early in the film when they're going through the asylum and they're about to transport comatose Michael Myers, and one of the doctors hears a scream and it like catches him off guard and goes, Jesus. And the orderly says, yeah, Jesus ain't got nothing to do with this place.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's like these weird little religious motifs throughout the whole movie, which again, just speaks to this movie dealing with themes and motifs that really, like, by the fourth film in most franchises, no one gives a shit about anymore.
Yeah. But I've always felt that is the nature of alluding to, you know, Michael Myers is a product of hell. He is the devil's or Samhain's, you know, spirit coming to wreak havoc or vengeance or whatever is going on that we're not privy to.
Right.
That is just darkness. That is just evil. That is coming to seed something in the earth.
Yeah.
But never actually going that far, never making it supernatural. So up until this point, Michael Myers can be killed and is theoretically killed.
And killed, like, and again, I want to talk about the sort of finality of what appears to be the end of this movie. And I got to say this, Danielle Harris, for being so young, one of the things that she really does well is she obviously is asked to be terrified a lot. Like, she spends a lot of the movie terrified, screaming, whatever. She does that well. But she also does it in a way that, like, she's so sweet. Like, you can't help but, like, but love her and really want her to get out of these perilous situations, because there's something about Danielle Harris and her screen presence, even as a young girl, that's just so sweet that you can't, your heart just immediately goes out to her. And at the end of the movie, that's why it's so fucking tragic. Like, that's the one thing we never got the full scope of the tragedy of young Michael Myers, because when we're introduced to him, it's a POV shot. We don't see this kid's face until after he's already committed this horrific act.
Yeah.
We've spent the entire movie with Jamie, the victim. And all of a sudden at the end of the movie, we realize she's been dressed as a clown. Like, but it's a costume she picked out,
yeah,
which should have been clue number one.
Well, and for many people it is. You see, her pick out the clown suit, and they even draw attention to it later. You know, cool clown suit.
By the same kids who were, like, literally mocking her for being an orphan earlier. I thought that was really weird. I was like, you literally just were making fun of her because she didn't have parents. Fuck you, kids. But then at the ending, like, we see that mask go on. We see that almost a mirror of that POV shot. And all of a sudden, she's stabbing her foster mother with scissors. And I love the reaction from Donald Pleasance when he comes up the stairs and sees her and starts going into his typical, no, no, no. But then he pulls a gun. He's going to shoot her.
I love how he became a bad impression of Harry Carey there.
The evil is gone from here. It's a weird yard. Center field. Oh, my. No, it like.
Evil's really were just one octave down from Harry
Carey. Evil just took a walk. It's 3-2 in the bottom of the seventh. But no, he pulls a gun. He's going to shoot a 6-year-old. Like, that is where his commitment, like, it's almost like, again, like going back to the whole biblical thing, like watching Abraham go up the mountain.
Yeah.
It's like, that's where his conviction is now. Like, that's how much he believes in the, that evil cannot be, dissuaded. Evil cannot be changed. It is as elemental as fire. Like, you can't hope to convince fire not to burn. He's going to shoot a 6-year-old in the face because he realizes that evil has been handed down.
Yeah.
That is a magnificently powerful ending.
Yeah, yeah. And that final shot with her holding the scissors and just standing there. And you feel as heartbroken as he does. Like,
yeah.
he's reacting for you. He's, you know, the Greek chorus,
yeah,
of the audience, where it's like, no, we've been with this girl the whole fucking movie, and now she's the bad guy.
Yeah.
And now we know that she's the next killer, and that the next movie could have been 10 years later. And this girl comes out of the asylum, or breaks out of the asylum. And that's not where they went.
No.
But they ended in a way that, as we said initially, it wraps up a perfect trilogy. And this ending is very similar, of course, to the final shot in Sleepaway Camp, where you find out that, one of the characters you've been running around with the entire movie and worried about is, in fact, the killer and is, in fact, the evil. Although this is that without the penis. So.
This is that without the penis.
Oh, God. You know, that's the thing is, Danielle Harris, for a certain generation of us, for guys who are of a certain age, and I know I share this with my buddies, Adam Green and Joe Lynch, who are my age. Danielle Harris is our age, and she was one of those big crushes. For those of us horror geeks growing up, Danielle Harris was a big crush.
Mm-hmm.
And wow, that wouldn't have happened if it had mimicked the final shot of Sleepaway Camp.
I don't know, man. You're the only thing more strong than the conviction Donald Pleasance has is the conviction you guys have to your boners. So
yeah.
It could have still worked.
Oddly enough, true story. I went to a horror convention years back. I went with a friend of mine, Angela Bettis, and she needed a body man for the convention because as some of you may be or may not be aware, women are not treated as kindly as men are. Particularly at horror conventions.
Crazy.
And you get a lot of weird, socially awkward people around pretty girls, and all of a sudden, weird stuff happens. So Angela would always have, at the time, her boyfriend, or if her boyfriend wasn't available, she'd ask one of her friends like me to go and hang out with her for the weekend at a horror convention. And so we went up to this horror convention, and Danielle Harris was there. And I'm not somebody who ever gets starstruck or gobsmacked by meeting celebrities. And I'm walking through the bar and, you know, Pinhead's there and Candyman's there. And I'm just like it's no thing. And then I'm like, oh, my God, Danielle Harris is sitting right there. Oh, my God, it's Danielle Harris sitting on the couch. And she looks up at me and makes eye contact. And all of a sudden, I have to turn my eyes and avert them and walk towards the bar very quickly. And
you became the awkward guy that you were specifically brought there
exactly,
to deter.
No. But that was one of those things where I was talking to Angela, and she was just like, oh, hey, if you're a fan, you should go up and talk to her. I'm like, I can't talk. No, I'm just going to be weird. I don't know what to say. It's weird. I can't go up. And how do you go up and talk to somebody that, hey, by the way, I'm a fan of your work, but I've had a crush on you since I was like 12 years old.
Yeah.
You know, no, it's just an awkward. So I was just like, yeah, no, that's a thing that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was one of the few times in my life that I've been completely gobsmacked and just thunderstruck and could not speak around somebody that I've watched in a film. And it was Danielle Harris, who, as many of you out there might be going, oh yeah, no, Danielle Harris, yeah, she was adorable. And watch her grow up and grew up with her, and still beautiful.
Yeah.
Still,
oh, very much.
Still fucking gorgeous.
I had a very similar reaction when I interviewed her when she was in town for Hatchet 2. Is like, you know, I didn't quite have a crush on her, but she was so, like, Halloween 4 was so important to my horror education.
And you watched it about the same time where you were that age.
And it was just like, this movie means a hell of a lot to me. And, like, getting to meet her and kind of talk to her about it was just surreal. And, yeah, no, I mean, and she's still beautiful. And she's as sweet as we would expect little Jamie to have grown up to Ben. So, but, yeah, Halloween 4... so good and so worthwhile, and it's a movie that really does, again, uphold the things that we loved about the original Halloween, brings the franchise kind of back to, gives it a direction again, unfortunately, that was immediately forgotten by the next two movies, but yeah, I'd highly recommend for this Halloween season or any other, The Return of Michael Myers.
Maybe nobody knows how to stop him.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing, and I had to go with the staple of the Halloween holiday itself, the caramel apple, because, you know, one of the things that they always tell you when you're a kid and you trick-or-treat is that, you know, all your candy has to be wrapped and then it has to be checked because you never know, and one of the great urban legends was, you know, the razor blade and the caramel apple, which is actually referenced in Halloween 2 in a very bizarre way. There's a little
but
kid.
It never actually happened. It's never been reported.
It's an urban legend. It's never actually happened. But in Halloween 2, we see a kid show up to that same hospital, the emergency room, who has a razor blade in his mouth. It's really like this kind of like Rick Rosenthal just being like, ha ha ha, Halloween sucks for everyone. And so I feel like whenever you dig into a franchise, an established franchise, you have to be careful because if you dig in too much and you just dive into whatever is there, sometimes when you take that bite, it bites back. And what I love about Halloween 4 is that it is the unwrapped but very checked and very safe horror sequel. Like, you don't have to worry about this one biting back when you take a big juicy bite out of it. So, yes, the candy apple, the caramel apple, Halloween 4, Return of Michael Myers. Thank you guys so much for joining us this week. We hope you have a safe and happy and horrific and amazing Halloween. God, I love this holiday so much. I hope you guys do as well and that you go out and experience it to the fullest. But if you would like to experience our past episodes, you can find them on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or at Facebook, facebook.com/massaworm.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. You can also find me at oneofus.net, my home away from home. Lots of great geek podcasts and blogs for every taste. You can also find me playing video games with Jeff over at Rage Select. But until next time, guys, I want to remind you that it's Halloween, so everyone's entitled to at least one good scare. But all the better if you can get 1, 2, 3, 4.